and the colossal statues of earlier Cleopatras, through the stone breakwaters and into her calm, splendidly engineered harbor. When a foreign sovereign visited, the Egyptian fleet headed out to meet him. It surely did so in full force now. No matter how she had advertised her errand at home, no matter what her actual agenda abroad, Cleopatra could hardly have envisioned this dismal conclusion. She had had a few weeks to come to terms with events and to look ahead. Whether she grieved personally or not, she had cause for apprehension. Not only was there no one to intervene on her behalf in Rome, but she had now inserted herself dangerously into the blood sport that was that city's politics. As Caesar's only son, Caesarion was her trump card. He was also a potential liability. She was, if anything, in greater danger than she had been in 48, when first she had found herself caught between two ambitious foreigners fighting to the death. If Cleopatra knew the irritating nuisance of self-doubt, all evidence has been lost to history. What Plutarch described as her supreme confidence instead survives her, along with her superlative powers of persuasion. On a later occasion, she would pass off a mission entirely botched as one expertly accomplished. It is difficult to believe that, having made her fragrant offerings on deck, she descended the gangplank in Alexandria, again a sovereign, safely returned to her admiring subjects, anything less than triumphantly. Footnote. There was plenty of precedent for this brand of inexactitude. Alexander the Great threw a festival to celebrate his conquest of India, which doubtless surprised the bedraggled, half-starved men who had barely survived that mission, having accomplished no such thing. End of footnote. She was free of rustic Rome, delivered from the swells of the waves and the turbulence abroad, to a land that recognized her as a living goddess, every bit Venus's equal, returned to a city where monarchy received its proper due, where a queen could hold her head high without being flailed for arrogance, where no one yelped over golden chairs or shuddered at the sight of diadems. She was, in short, back in civilization. That was particularly evident over an Egyptian summer, the season of celebrations. In its festivals, too, Cleopatra's kingdom inverted the Roman order. With the fields underwater, Egypt devoted itself to song, dance, and feasting. Home is best, went the Greek adage, and so it must have felt to Cleopatra, returning from a land that defined the word differently. Alexandria, Cicero had railed years earlier, is home of all deceit and falsehood. It is unclear who managed Egyptian affairs while Cleopatra was abroad. Normally she would have entrusted matters to her minister of finance, but whoever he was, he did so expertly. She returned to a kingdom that was prosperous and at peace, no small order given her absence or absences. There are no extant protests concerning tax collection, no evidence of the kind of revolt that had greeted her father's return. The temples continued to flourish. Cleopatra slipped smoothly back into her role. The disturbing news came from abroad. In her exile, Arsinoe, Cleopatra's younger sister, persisted in her designs on the throne. Reprising her coup of 4 years earlier, Arsinoe marshaled enough support in Ephesus to have herself proclaimed Queen of Egypt. Her feat speaks both to her tenacity and to the fragility of Cleopatra's position outside her country. The temple of Artemis was filled with priceless treasure. Arsinoe appears to have had Roman backers, as well as a family or a faux family accomplice. At about this time, a pretender materialized, claiming to be Ptolemy XIII, miraculously resuscitated after his Nile drowning of 3 years earlier. Certainly the two sisters despised each other. Arsinoe may have gone so far as to have suborned Cleopatra's commander in Cyprus, whose loyalties wavered. It was an easy trip from Cyprus to Ephesus. The Cyprus commander was traditionally a high-ranking official. To complicate matters, Cleopatra had another brother at her side, the expendable and possibly disloyal Ptolemy XIV. There's a common proverb scolding people who trip twice over the same stone, Cicero had observed, and Cleopatra, vulnerable again on two fronts, was not prone to clumsiness. At some point over the summer, she arranged for the murder of Ptolemy XIV, allegedly by poison. Footnote. This happened by necessity in the best of families, Plutarch assures us, monarchy being so utterly unsociable a thing. The rules for dispensing with fellow royals were, he held, as inflexible as those of geometry. End of footnote. Whether the 15-year-old had been in league with their exiled sister or not, he was clearly unnecessary, an insult to Cleopatra's autonomy. His murder allowed her to proclaim Caesarion her co-regent, which she did that summer. At some point after July, a newly eponymous month that occurred in 44 for the first time, to much gnashing of teeth at Cicero's address, Caesarion was named pharaoh. With his ascension began the third of Cleopatra's co-regencies. Hers was an original solution, also an ideal one. Caesarion became King Ptolemy, who is as well Caesar, father-loving, mother-loving god. Cleopatra had her obligatory male consort. A Roman and a doubly divine one sat on the Egyptian throne, and a 3-year-old was unlikely to meddle in any way with his mother's agenda. Not only was hers a brilliant strategic calculation, Cleopatra symbolically swathed Egypt in Caesar's mantle, for which she could see a violent contest brewing. It was also a deft iconographical one. If Caesar had returned from Alexandria more royal than before, Cleopatra returned from Rome more godly. She vigorously embraced her role as Isis, with full emphasis on her maternal command, a novel instance of coaxing a promotion from childbearing. At festivals, she appeared in her striking Isis attire. Recent events provided a powerful assist. Caesar's assassination may have destroyed Cleopatra's years of meticulous planning, but represented a boon to the imagery. In the legend, the enemies of Osiris, Isis's earthly partner and the supreme male divinity, savagely dismember him. Osiris leaves behind a young male heir and a devoted, quick-thinking consort. In Isis's grief, she collects the butchered pieces to effect his resurrection. The Ides of March handily buttressed the tale. Cleopatra emerged stronger for her loss, the great wife of a martyred deity. It did not hurt that in Rome, on the first day of 42, Caesar was, in a solemn religious ceremony, declared a god. Publicly, Cleopatra played up the role of Isis as provider of wisdom and of material and spiritual sustenance, advertising Caesarion's presence, the family trinity, and the spiritual rebirth. Footnote. Florence Nightingale was among those who marveled at the parallels between the Osiris and Christ stories. In Upper Egypt, she sat spellbound through a Sunday morning in an Isis temple, one largely decorated by Cleopatra's father. Few places had felt to her so sacred. "I cannot describe to you the feeling at Philae," she wrote her family in 1850. "The myths of Osiris are so typical of our Savior that it seemed to me as if I were coming to a place where he had lived, like going to Jerusalem. And when I saw a shadow in the moonlight in the temple court, I thought, perhaps I shall see him. Now he is there." End of footnote. she embarked on an ambitious building program, in much of which she exploited the myth. Caesarion survives in relief on the walls of the Temple of Dendera, a vast project Cleopatra's father had inherited. Possibly to celebrate her son's ascension, Cleopatra had him carved, with the crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt standing before her, offering incense to Isis, Horus, Osiris. It was an effective conflation of themes. She follows him as both pharaoh and mother, in one depiction shaking an Isis rattle and wearing the goddess's traditional double-crown headdress. Her name takes precedence in the caption below. She likely inaugurated the carvings. She completed work her father had begun at Idfu, in Upper Egypt, to which she probably transferred the teams of Dendera workmen. She established a boat shrine at Koptos, farther north, and built a small sanctuary celebrating the births of divine children behind the main temple at Hermonthis, near Luxor. Caesarion is closely associated there with Horus, who, perhaps not incidentally, is to avenge the death of his father. Cleopatra may already have begun a massive structure dedicated to Caesar and known later as the Caesarium, above the Alexandrian harbor. It would ultimately constitute a precinct unto itself, of porticos, libraries, chambers, groves, gateways, broad walks, and courts fitted with exquisite art. Her largest project was a temple of Isis in Alexandria, entirely lost today. On other fronts as well, she was in the resurrection business. Under Cleopatra, Alexandria enjoyed a robust intellectual revival. Gathering a coterie of thinkers around her, Cleopatra reconstituted a Greek intelligentsia in the city, to which she had no difficulty luring scholars. Among her intimates, she counted Philostratus, an orator celebrated for his spellbinding extemporaneous performances. He may also have been her personal tutor. The only indigenous school of philosophy emerged under Cleopatra. A skeptic, Inesidemus of Knossos, wrangled with the relativity of human perceptions and the impossibility of knowledge. Scholarly work in grammar and history enjoyed a renaissance, although the revival generated few of the dizzyingly original theoretical leaps of previous centuries. Medicine and pharmacology represented the sole exceptions. Doctors had long been attached to the Ptolemaic court, where they were influential, public-spirited statesmen, and where in Cleopatra's reign, the most eminent men in their fields wrote prolifically on medicine and maladies, on eye and lung ailments, both as scholars and practitioners. In surgery particularly, these thinkers made bold strides, producing a new body of specialized skills. The work was otherwise derivative, prone to sterility, given more to classification than to creativity. To it came the first native Alexandrian scholars. 4 years Cleopatra's junior and the son of a local saltfish seller, Didymus distinguished himself at court for his lively wit and his prodigious output. He discoursed perceptively on the lexicon, on Homer, on Demosthenes, on history, drama, and poetry. In several volumes, he lobbed some satirical shots even at Cicero. It is a wonder he had time for his sovereign. Maniacally productive, Didymus turned out more than 3,500 treatises and commentaries, which may explain why he could not remember what he had written and stood regularly accused of contradicting himself. These were the men with whom Cleopatra dined, with whom she lived in close contact and discussed affairs of state. The household thinker served as intellectual stimulus or as confessor and conscience. He was at once mentor and servant. Collectively, the early 40s are the years that prove Cleopatra to have been far more than the sum of her supposed seductions. She made her first steps toward restoring Ptolemaic glory, again following her father's lead, though with more quantifiable results. She supported and engaged with intellectual endeavors, as befitted her heritage. Hellenistic sovereigns were, by definition, cultural patrons and scholars. Among Cleopatra's forebears were plenty of murderers, also a historian, a zoologist, a playwright. Ptolemy I wrote a much-admired account of Alexander the Great. Reading backward, we are left to gauge Cleopatra's reputation by what was falsely attributed to her. She has received extracurricular credit for a diverse body of literature, which says something of her profile. A decadent abroad, she was an able-bodied intellectual at home. She has been variously cited as an authority on magic and medicine, inseparable still for some time, on hairdressing, on cosmetics, on weights and measures. These were realms Cleopatra may well have explored, at least at the dinner table. As for medicine, she was a great patron of the Temple of Hathor, devoted to female health. She was, all the same, only slightly more likely to have written about baths of ass's milk than to have invented aspirin. A curious cure for baldness would be credited to Cleopatra. She was said to counsel a paste of equal parts burnt mice, burnt rag, burnt horse's teeth, bear's grease, deer marrow, and reed bark. Mixed with honey, the salve was to be applied to the scalp, rubbed until it sprouts. Plutarch holds that she concocted all sorts of deadly poisons with which she experimented on prisoners. When she saw that the speedy poisons enhanced the sharpness of death by the pain they caused, she moved on to a survey of venomous animals. These she studied systematically, daily, watching with her own eyes as they were set one upon another. The Talmud hails her for her great scientific curiosity, and as very interested in the experiments of doctors and surgeons. Given the preponderance of medical professionals at court, the progress in the field, and the lively interest demonstrated in the natural sciences by other Eastern kings, many of whom performed experiments and wrote on biology and botany, this was likely true. The rest of the Talmudic passage may be less so. It attributes to Cleopatra a set of experiments on female prisoners in order to determine at what point the fetus became an actual embryo. Similarly, the medieval Genetia Cleopatrae is doubtless apocryphal. It includes instructions for a vaginal suppository that I always used and my sister Arsinoe tried. Leaving aside the question as to whether Cleopatra and her usurping younger sister are likely to have traded contraceptive tips over the years when they were more likely plotting each other's murder, the text is problematic for having been written in Latin. Cleopatra was rumored to be especially skilled in the occult sciences, though the only alchemy she worked was in turning the fields of Egypt into gold. Much of Cleopatra's supposed scholarship derives from the Arab world, where Roman propaganda did not penetrate. There she established herself as a philosopher, physician, scientist, scholar. Her name was powerfully resonant, the more so for her association with the pharmacologically inclined, miracle-working Isis. As credible as were some of its imputations, it is difficult to determine how many of the accomplishments were genuine, how many the flattering fallout of Plutarch's account of an intellectually inclined woman, comfortable in the company of philosophers and physicians, living in enlightened times, and how much they constitute the usual assault on the composed, capable woman, suspect for being too good at her craft, whose talents can be attributed only to magic arts and charms. Dissected or not, the bodies must be buried somewhere, the cauldrons and the books of spells nearby. Cleopatra's abilities were great, but the fertile male fancy incontestably greater. Her competence would be put to the test in the years following the return, when disaster followed upon disaster. The Nile did not stir over the spring of 43, and that summer failed to rise at all. it proved equally uncooperative the following year. Crops failed to a degree that defied the historical record. Throughout Egypt, the misery was acute. Cleopatra eventlessly steered her kingdom through the sustained crisis, doubtless careful about tripping over familiar stones. The previous famine had been a fiasco for her. She may again have declared a state of emergency. Her people were starving. She had little choice but to open the royal granaries and distribute free wheat. Footnote. She would be accused of having withheld distributions from the city's Jews, which is unlikely. Customarily, the Jews were loyal supporters of the female Ptolemies. They were river guards, police officers, army commanders, and high-ranking officials. They had fought for Auletes. They numbered among Cleopatra's supporters in the desert in 48, and they had fought for her during the Alexandrian War, at the end of which Caesar had granted them citizenship. End of footnote. Inflation raged. Cleopatra further devalued the currency. Petitioners from two districts appeared before her for relief from venal tax collectors. Given the general malaise, and inspired by a hatred of evil, she granted them exemptions. She posted notices of amnesty widely. In the midst of the agricultural crisis came reports of odd glandular swellings and nasty black pustules. An epidemic raged either in Egypt or just beyond its borders. The prolific Dioscorides, an expert on medicinal plants, had ample material on which to base a pioneering treatise on bubonic plague. The timing was particularly inauspicious as the Roman Civil War returned violently in 43 to Egypt's shores. The Italian peninsula could hardly contain that conflict, a brutal, fitful demonstration that, in Plutarch's words, no wild beast is more savage than man when his passion is supplemented by power. For Cleopatra, the infighting took the form of a sort of perverse fairy tale. She knew that all parties would come calling. The number of appeals attests to her sustained wealth. She also knew that to back the wrong party was to invite disaster. While she remained answerable to Rome, it was difficult to do so when she did not know who precisely Rome was. And no matter whom she endorsed, the cost was likely to be exorbitant. Already she was well acquainted with the wisdom offered to her father, bluntly apprised in the midst of his negotiations as to what humiliations and troubles he would run himself into, what bribery he must resort to, and what cupidity he would have to satisfy when he came to the leading men at Rome, whom all Egypt turned into silver, would scarcely content. Cleopatra's best option would have been to do nothing, an option she quickly exhausted. She went finally with her natural sympathies, and at her price. Dolabella had been high in Caesar's favor, his precocious fleet commander, his first choice for consul in 44. He was dissolute and hot-headed, also robust, a fine speaker, and a popular favorite. Still in his 20s, he may have struck Cleopatra as Caesar's natural political heir. When Dolabella applied for assistance, Cleopatra sent him the four legions Caesar had left her, along with a fleet. In exchange, she secured a promise that Caesarion would be recognized as king of Egypt, a confirmation crucial to her. Unfortunately, her fleet was intercepted on the high seas. Without a struggle, it defected to Cassius, Dolabella's rival, and a leader among the assassins. In turn, Cassius prevailed upon Cleopatra for assistance. She sent her excuses. Famine and plague ravaged her country. She was utterly without resources. Simultaneously, she prepared a second expedition for Dolabella. Foul winds confined that fleet to the harbor, and she met with rebellious subordinates. Her military commander in Cyprus countermanded her order, supplying Cassius with Egyptian ships. Cleopatra would be called upon to answer for his defiance later. She was playing a dangerous game that only became more so. In July 43, Cassius's army encircled and crushed Dolabella, who committed suicide. If she had not already done so, Cleopatra heard next from Cassius's enemies, Octavian and Antony. The two were in league at the end of 43, intent on revenge against the assassins, primarily led by Brutus and Cassius. For Octavian, Caesar's adopted son and his former consul, Cleopatra readied a powerful fleet, loaded down with materiel. She intended to deliver it personally to Greece. Meanwhile, the assassin Cassius menaced her. She refused to rise to the bait. He threatened again. He had asked only for her cooperation. Cleopatra had instead assisted his enemy. She was by no means proving the obedient female Caesar had advertised. Enraged, Cassius prepared a full-scale Egyptian invasion. The timing was right. Egypt was weak with famine, Cleopatra vulnerable in the absence of her Roman legions. She later insisted that she had not been terrified of Cassius, but she would have been foolish not to have been. He was a noxious character composed of equal parts cruelty and greed. Known as the most aggressive of men, he had been a prime mover among the assassins. He had 12 first-rate legions at his command, as well as an expert force of mounted bowmen. He had been pitiless with those cities into which he had already marched. A skilled general and a former Pompeian admiral, he had fought in the east before, and he was already close at hand, across the Egyptian border where he had seized control of Syria. Yet again, Cleopatra was spared in the nick of time by competing Roman interests. As he began his march toward Egypt, Cassius was diverted by an urgent summons. Antony and Octavian had crossed the Adriatic. They traveled east to challenge him. Cassius hesitated. Egypt was a rich prize within easy reach. Sternly, Brutus reminded him that he was not meant to win power for himself, but liberty for his country. The disappointed Cassius reversed direction to join Brutus in Greece. For Cleopatra, the reprieve coincided with unhappy events. She had headed out with her fleet to join Antony and Octavian. She herself commanded the flagship. Yet again, foul weather intervened. In its face, a high, square-rigged warship was useless, quickly swamped, easily overturned. She returned to Alexandria with a battered remnant of a navy. As she explained later, the storm not only ruined everything, but also caused her to fall ill, for which reason she had not put to sea even afterwards. Some have questioned her sincerity, giving Cleopatra's story a suspect, "I didn't want to get my heels wet" spin. It is notable that when she is not condemned for being too bold and masculine, Cleopatra is taken to task for being unduly frail and feminine. She appears to have been true to her word, however. She knew she could not deny assistance to those actively avenging her lover's death. And a Cassius ally who lay in wait to ambush Cleopatra's fleet, with a fleet of 60 decked ships, a legion of Cassius's men, and a stockpile of flaming arrows, both heard of the disaster and came across Egyptian wreckage floating off the coast of southern Greece. Cleopatra limped home in ill health. For her careful and costly efforts, she had secured the allegiance of no one. Having offered the victors no effective assistance, Cleopatra knew she would be held to account soon enough. An emissary arrived in Alexandria, more or less on cue, probably early in 41. He was a suave and tart-tongued negotiator, also a man of acrobatic loyalties. Already Quintus Dellius had changed sides 3 times in the course of the civil war, having leapt from Dolabella's camp to Cassius's to touch down temporarily in Mark Antony's. He had come to Alexandria to exact some answers from the oddly uncooperative Queen of Egypt. Why had she collaborated with Cassius? How to explain her tepid support of the Caesareans? Where precisely were her loyalties? Presumably, Delius had been briefed on the wonders of Alexandria and its jewel-encrusted palace. Whatever he had heard failed to prepare him adequately for Cleopatra. He had no sooner seen her face and remarked her adroitness and subtlety in speech than he realized he would need to reassess his approach. On Cleopatra's disarming effect, all sources unanimously, even actively, agree. Plutarch, so much falls under her posthumous spell that from the moment of Delius's arrival, he essentially lets her run off with Mark Antony's narrative. Delius quickly grasped that he would not be delivering up a sorry, subdued queen for arraignment. The woman before him was not the kind who could be asked to explain herself. Opportunist that he was, he may have seen that something else could be made of the situation. He was himself highly susceptible to beauty. From their lusty escapades together, he knew well the tastes of his commanding officer. Delius either melted into Cleopatra's hands, realized Antony would, or both. Fortunately, the flip side of his inconstancy was a nearly double-jointed agility. He executed an effortless about-face. He flattered and fawned, so much that it is unclear whose agenda he ultimately advanced. His advice was, Delius deserves long overdue points for stage management, to engage in a little play-acting. Cleopatra was to put on her finest clothes. Her situation was analogous to that of Hera in the Iliad, who kneads her skin to a soft glow, anoints herself with enticing oils, braids her bright tresses, wraps herself in ambrosial robes, cinches her waist with tassels, and gold brooches at her breast and gems dangling from her ears, strides off to meet Zeus. Cleopatra was to come abroad with him post-haste. She had, Delius assured her, nothing to fear. Mark Antony was the gentlest and kindest of soldiers. 3 years earlier, as Cleopatra had hurried from Rome under a dull April sky, she crossed paths with another wary traveler. Though he did so as a private citizen, Octavian had made his way to Rome accompanied by a remarkable crowd which increased every day like a torrent and borne along by a current of goodwill. Either at the time or in the retelling, he was greeted by the ancient equivalent of special effects. As he neared the Appian Way, the fog lifted, and a great halo with the colors of the rainbow surrounded the whole sun, which had not been seen for weeks. Caesar's heir was as unknown to his followers as they were to him. They flocked to his side, none more enthusiastically than the veterans of Caesar's campaigns, with the expectation that the 18-year-old would avenge the butchery in the Senate. He was noncommittal on that front, proceeding on his mother's advice, craftily and patiently, at least until he set foot on Antony's property. The sallow provincial teenager with the curly blonde hair and the eyebrows that joined above his nose had hardly distinguished himself. He had spent little time in Rome. He had neither military experience nor political authority. His constitution was frail, his figure unprepossessing. He had arrived to claim the most coveted inheritance of the age, the name of his granduncle. Bright and early the next morning, Octavian presented himself at the forum to accept Caesar's adoption. He proceeded to call on Mark Antony in the garden of his fine estate, to which Octavian was admitted only after a lengthy, humiliating delay. No matter how he announced himself, already his followers called him Caesar. The call would have rankled. If for Cleopatra, Octavian's appearance in Rome was uncomfortable. It was, for Mark Antony, an insult. A strained conversation followed between two men, or, in the 40-year-old Antony's opinion, a man and a boy, who felt they had equal right to Caesar's legacy. Octavian was precise and deliberative, later something of a control freak. He no doubt practiced his remarks in advance. Even when speaking to his wife, he preferred to write out his thoughts and read them aloud. Certainly Octavian delivered those in 44 with chilling confidence and candor. Why had Antony failed to prosecute the assassins? For the sake of order, everyone had urged an amnesty. Antony had presided over the Senate when it was granted, however. The prime movers were not only alive, but had been rewarded with provincial governorships and military commands. Octavian entreated his elder to stand behind me and help me take revenge on the murderers. If he could not, would he please step respectfully aside? After all, Antony might just as well have been Caesar's political heir had he conducted himself more prudently. As for the inheritance, could Antony kindly hand over the gold Caesar had left for the promised distributions? Octavian added that Antony could keep the valuables and other finery, less an invitation than an accusation. Mark Antony was more than twice Octavian's age. He had all the prestige of his long service with Caesar. Over the previous 2 years, he had exercised great, if not always decorous, authority. He had, moreover, already liquidated Octavian's inheritance, as he had earlier made a shambles of Pompey's former home, liberally bestowing magnificent tapestries and furniture on friends. He did not need to be reminded that he had narrowly missed out on adoption by the man he too admired above all others. Nor did he need to be lectured by a diminutive, self-righteous upstart. He was much taken aback. In his rich, raspy voice, he reminded the young man before him that political leadership in Rome was not hereditary. Comporting himself as if it were had got Caesar murdered. Antony had run plenty of risks to ensure that Caesar was buried with honors, plenty more for the sake of his memory. It was entirely thanks to him, he testily informed Octavian, that you in fact possess all the distinctions of Caesar's that you do, family, name, rank, and wealth. Antony owed no explanations. He deserved gratitude rather than blame. Unable to resist, as he often was, Antony added a little poison dart to his message, upbraiding the stripling for his disrespect. And you a young man, and I your senior. Octavian was moreover mistaken if he believed Antony coveted political power or resented the newcomer's position. Descent from Hercules is quite good enough for me, huffed Antony, who, broad-shouldered, bull-necked, ridiculously handsome, with a thick head of curls and aquiline features, entirely looked the part. As for money, there was none in his hands. Octavian's brilliant father had left the treasury quite empty. Explosive though it was, that interview came as a relief to the Senate, to which there was only one danger greater than a public feud between two Caesarians. Antony wielded political power. Octavian was respected and surprisingly popular. Enthusiastic demonstrations greeted him throughout his travels. Far better that the two rivals obstruct each other, went the thinking, than that they join forces. Antony noted as much in his garden that spring morning. Octavian was fresh from his studies. Certainly, in the course of them, he had learned that the populace considered it their business to prolong discord, that they built up demagogues for the pleasure of knocking them down, that they encouraged them to destroy each other. He was, of course, right, and no one was better at fomenting dissension than Cicero, who could always be counted on, as a contemporary put it, to malign the prominent, blackmail the powerful, slander the distinguished. He now gamely obliged. To Cicero, the contest was a baneful one between weakness and villainy. In truth, there were a dizzying number of options. Among Caesar's assassins, Brutus and Cassius remained very much in the picture. A bold young man with a gift for assembling armies, Pompey's son was in Spain with the greater part of the Roman navy. Sextus Pompey had on his side his own father's still bright reputation. He, too, was looking to avenge a parent and recover an inheritance. He arguably had a greater claim on vengeance. As an adolescent, he had witnessed his father's beheading off the coast of Egypt. The consul Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, having succeeded Antony as Caesar's second in command, having dined with Caesar the night before his murder, dreamed, too, of succeeding Caesar. He controlled a faction of Caesar's army. Additional legions reported to additional consuls. Brutus had unexpectedly raised his army in record time. Footnote. To complicate matters, there were both assassins and would-be assassins who, the French resistance fighters of their day, enlisted after the fact. Also to complicate matters, Lepidus and Cassius were brothers-in-law. Both were related by marriage as well to Brutus. End of footnote. It seemed that Octavian alone was without a command. The most influential man in Rome after the Ides, Cicero found himself in much the same bind as Cleopatra. Which side to join? He could see that neutrality would on this occasion, the fifth civil war of his lifetime, not be possible. At the same time, he knew all the parties in question and was enchanted by none. In 44, Octavian struck him as a mere schoolboy, a nuisance rather than a prospect. "I don't trust his age, and I don't know what he's after," Cicero carped. It was difficult to imagine Octavian, a pale-faced teenager in a city that preferred its complexions ruddy, as a commander-in-chief. He proffered himself as leader, and yet was so naive as to believe that Rome could keep a secret. It is interesting that few deigned to take Octavian seriously at 18, at which age Cleopatra already ruled Egypt. By May 44, when Cicero felt Rome no longer safe for him, he settled on Dolabella, though with a wrinkle. That dashing commander had for 4 years been his son-in-law. Dolabella and Cicero's daughter had divorced during her pregnancy. Dolabella had subsequently been slow to repay the dowry, as he was obliged to do. Once an ardent Caesarian, Dolabella turned after the Ides against his former benefactor. He pretended even to have been party to the conspiracy, which he publicly approved. Cicero cheered loudly from the sidelines. As of May 1st, his former son-in-law was "my wonderful Dolabella." Stocky, long-haired Dolabella delivered a star performance of a speech. Cicero slobbered in admiration. Dolabella had so eloquently defended the assassins that Brutus could practically wear a crown himself. "Surely," Cicero assured him, "Dolabella knew already of his deep regard." More likely, Dolabella knew of just the opposite. Dolabella destroyed a makeshift column raised to Caesar's memory. He suppressed pro-Caesarian demonstrations. Cicero's esteem only grew. No affection was ever more ardent, he effused. The Republic rested on Dolabella's shoulders. A week later, Cicero was through with his former son-in-law. "The gall of the man," he spat, declaring himself a bitter enemy. What had happened in the interim? Despite the fusillade of compliments, Dolabella had neglected to make good on his debt. There was a moment of reprieve. Cicero could not help but repeatedly congratulate Dolabella for a brilliant tirade against Antony, long the way to Cicero's heart. On that count, too, personal animosities trumped political issues. Trusted associates of Caesar, both, Dolabella and Mark Antony, had for several years been at odds following a certain indiscretion on the part of Antony's then wife. For the same reason, she abruptly became his ex-wife. Sometimes it indeed seemed as if there were only 10 women in Rome, and in Cicero's view, Mark Antony had slept with every one of them. Politics have long been defined as the systematic organization of hatreds. Certainly nothing better described Rome in the years following the Ides, when enmity rather than issues divided Caesar's assassins, Caesar's heirs, and the last of the Pompeians, each of whom, it seemed, had an army, an agenda, and ambitions of his own. Among the bumper crop of personal vendettas, none was more savage than that of Cicero and Mark Antony. The bad blood went back decades. Antony's father had died when he was 10, leaving so many debts that Antony had declined his inheritance. His stepfather, a celebrated orator, had been sentenced to death on Cicero's orders. From his father, Mark Antony inherited a joyful, capricious temperament. He was given to sulks and sprees. His mother, by all accounts a force of nature, appeared to have fostered in her reckless son a taste for competent, strong-minded women. Without them, Antony arguably would have self-destructed well before March 44. Already, his personal life was something of a catastrophe. He cemented the family reputation for insolvency while still in his teens. His sterling military reputation was eclipsed only by his fame as a reveler. He left tutors half-dead in his carousing wake. He was given to good living, great parties, bad women. He was generous to a fault, always easier when the house you are rashly giving away is not yours in the first place. What was said of an earlier tribune was more true of Antony. He was a spendthrift of money and chastity, his own and other people's. The brilliant cavalry officer had all of Caesar's charm and none of his self-control. In 44, the conspirators had deemed him too inconsistent to be dangerous. After the Ides, Mark Antony was in his glory, entirely the man of the hour, at least until Octavian arrived. Cleopatra was not yet reinstalled in Alexandria when the first tensions were felt. They were entirely public. All over the city, Appian relates, Octavian would climb up onto any elevated spot and accuse Antony at the top of his voice. Antony might treat him with as much indignity as he liked. He might condemn him to a life of poverty, thundered Octavian. But would he please stop plundering his property until the citizens have had their legacy? He could then take all the rest. Antony hotly bellowed back. He was insulting and obstructionist whenever possible. The Senate did nothing to discourage either man, preferring instead, as Dio has it, and as Antony had predicted, to set them at odds with each other. Antony's men urged reconciliation, all the more crucial as the assassins consolidated their forces. Antony apologized. He promised to control his temper, provided that Octavian did the same. One uneasy truce followed another. Antony broke the second with a sensational charge. In October, he accused Octavian of bribing Antony's bodyguards to murder him. In truth, Octavian had only tried to bribe them to defect, a practice of which he would make a regular habit. As for Mark Antony's safety, Octavian offered personally to stand guard at his bedside. Most believed the charge preposterous. Some did not, which left Octavian apoplectic. On one occasion, he was reduced to pummeling the locked door of Mark Antony's house in an attempt to clear his name, wildly shouting oath after oath at the servants and at a plank of wood. Courted assiduously by Octavian, who wrote to him daily, Cicero played for time. It was a delicate business. Were Octavian to come to power, the assassins were lost. Moreover, Octavian was at once alarmingly impressionable and curiously resistant to advice from his elders. Cicero had particular difficulty with the young man's florid encomiums of Caesar. On the other hand, Cicero reasoned, if he is beaten, you can see that Antony will be intolerable, so one can't tell which to prefer. Antony was bent on plunder, Octavian blinded by vengeance. Cicero hemmed and hawed, fixing finally on one certainty, which he repeated like a mantra. The man who crushes Mark Antony will have finished this ghastly and perilous war. By the fall of 44, defending the Commonwealth, or what remained of it, became to Cicero synonymous with mauling Antony, against whom he fulminated for the next 6 months. It was in the course of those harrowing weeks that Cleopatra found herself entangled with Antony and Octavian's real enemies. Collaborating as she was, ingenuously and disingenuously, with Dolabella and Cassius. In the rabid attacks we know as the Philippics, Cicero set out to destroy Caesar's former lieutenant. Antony was at best an audacious rascal, at worst an erratic, drunken, filthy, shameless, depraved, licentious, pillaging madman. In truth, asserted Cicero, we ought not to think of him as a human being, but as a most outrageous beast. Certainly Antony gave Cicero plenty to work with. He had mismanaged funds. He had indulged in scandalous affairs. He had appropriated property. He had made a spectacle of himself, at one point allegedly attaching lions to a chariot for a joyride through Rome. Excess and conviviality were his middle names. His colorful stunts accounted in large part for his popularity. To his men, he was irresistible. There had been ample carousing, even if the fume of debauch did not attach itself to Antony quite as tenaciously as Cicero insisted. He was, all the same, happy to retail and amplify tales of Antony's indignities. The morning he had opened his mouth to speak in the Senate, and instead vomited the putrid remains of a wedding feast into his lap, was not one Cicero would ever let him forget. Antony was, henceforth, the belching, vomiting brute, prone to spewing rather than speaking. He had no ambition beyond providing for Rome's actors, gamblers, pimps. On this subject, Cicero was inexhaustible. As he had admitted long before, it is easy to inveigh against profligacy. Daylight would soon fail me if I were to endeavor to expose everything which could be said upon that topic. Seduction, adultery, wantonness, extravagance, the topic is illimitable. Footnote. A truly eloquent man is the one who can argue both sides of a case with equal finesse. And so, if by chance you find anyone who despises the sight of beautiful things, Cicero noted in the same speech, whom neither scent nor touch nor taste seduces, whose ears are deaf to all sweet sounds, such a man, I perhaps, and some few, will account heaven's favorite, but most the object of its wrath. As it happened, Cicero lived in one of the grandest mansions in the grandest quarters of Rome, for which he had paid an astronomical sum. And while he was pleased that one of his villas had an air of high thinking that rebukes the wild extravagance of other country houses, he had to admit that an addition to it would be awfully nice. End of footnote. So he proved on the subject of Mark Antony. As the abuse continued, two new themes emerged. Octavian inevitably went from being the boy to my young friend to this extraordinary youngster to that heaven-sent young man on whom Rome's hopes rested. Also, as Cicero ranted, Antony gained a partner in crime. Summoning every speck of evidence, rumor, and innuendo, Cicero included Fulvia, Antony's wife of 3 years, in his rabid denunciations. Fulvia had participated equally in doling out appointments, auctioning off provinces, embezzling state funds, asserted Cicero. He indicted her for her greed, her ambition, her cruelty, her guile. He charged Antony with the worst crime that could be leveled against Caesar's former lieutenant. "Mark Antony," he bellowed, "would prefer to answer to a most audacious woman than the Senate and Roman people." With his "have you no decency" offensive, Cicero settled an invaluable inheritance on Octavian, who would avail himself of each and every line without once crediting the best ghostwriter in history. By November 43, Octavian and Antony had little choice but to join forces. It was that winter that Brutus and Cassius united in the eastern Aegean, Cassius having relinquished his expedition against Cleopatra. The assassins were well armed and well funded. Bowing to necessity, Antony and Octavian swallowed their mutual disdain and submitted to a formal alliance. In it, they included Lepidus, who commanded a particularly spirited army. Late in the month, the three came together on a small island in the midst of present-day Bologna to exchange enmity for friendship. They frisked one another for concealed daggers and sat down to talk in full view of their armies. There they remained for 2 days of dawn to dusk discussions, unsurprising given the conflicting agendas. As the Roman historian Florus put it much later, Lepidus was actuated by a desire for wealth, which he might expect to gain from confusion in the state. Antony desired vengeance upon those who had declared him an enemy. Caesar Octavian was spurred on by the thought that his father's death was still unpunished, and that the survival of Cassius and Brutus was an insult to his departed spirit. At the end of 2 days, the three nonetheless hammered out an agreement, essentially appointing themselves dictators for 5 years and carving up the empire among them. Each man swore to uphold the terms and joined hands. On the mainland, their exultant armies saluted one another. The agreement, to be known later as the Second Triumvirate, was to take effect as of January 42. Cleopatra could only have been relieved. Together, Octavian and Antony had a chance. She was in no position to head off the combined forces of Brutus and Cassius, who would show no mercy to an ally of Caesar's, less so to one who ruled with his child. The new triumvirs addressed as well the pressing question of finances. The money was all in Asia, where it streamed freely into the assassins' coffers. In Rome, the treasury remained empty. That state of affairs led inevitably to the sticky subject of personal enemies. The three men withdrew to compile a list in private. There was some high-level horse trading as they offered up their staunchest friends in return for their bitterest enemies. In such a way, Antony sacrificed a much-loved uncle for Cicero. Lepidus threw over a brother. Your chances of survival were especially poor if you had funds at your disposal. Extra names were constantly added to the list, some from enmity, others only because they had been a nuisance, or were friends of enemies, or enemies of friends, or were notably wealthy, Appian tells us. Separately, the triumvirs hastened with their men to Rome, where they presided over a season of bloodletting. The whole city, notes Dio, filled with corpses, often left in the street to be devoured by dogs and birds, or cast into the river. Some of the proscribed descended for safety into wells or filthy sewers. Others took refuge in chimneys. Footnote. One wife hit on a particularly ingenious solution. She secreted her husband off to the coast in a hemp or leather sack. the kind into which Cleopatra had crawled. End of footnote. Having abandoned various plans for escape, Cicero was at his country villa, south of Rome, on December 7th, 43. He had lain down for a rest when a crow flew in the window and began to peck at the bedcovers. His servants read this as a sign of impending danger. They begged Cicero to allow them to carry him to the sea. He would be well hidden in the dense wood along the way. Reluctantly, he climbed into his litter, a copy of Euripides in his hand. Minutes later, a centurion broke down the door of his villa. Exacting the information he needed, he ran ahead to intercept the litter on the path. Cicero ordered his terrified servants to set him down among the trees. He wanted to look his murderer in the eye. The great man was unkempt and haggard, his face wasted with anxiety. Drawing the curtain fully open, he stretched his neck out as far as he could, so that it might be cut properly. He suspected that he was in the hands of an amateur, as indeed he was. With some inexpert sawing, Cicero's head was severed from his body. By Antony's prior command, the hands that had penned the Philippics were hacked off as well, to be sent from